Welcome to our Pharmaceutical Executive Podcast Series on pricing and policy in pharma with Model N strategy experts Jesse Mendelson and Michael Grossberg. I'm Mike Ristel, Group Managing Editor at MJH Life Sciences. For our latest episode, I'm joined by Jesse in studio to dive into the world of pharmacy benefit managers and how manufacturers can navigate what they see as costly operational breakdowns in today's PBM system. Jesse is a Senior Vice President at Model N, where he manages the company's services business for life sciences. Jesse has been with Model N since 2005, previously serving as the regulatory lead. He has deep experience in pharmaceutical pricing, revenue, payer management, and government regulation, and speaks regularly at national conferences on compliance topics. Jesse, thanks for joining us here in studio. It's great to have you.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So glad you can make it. All right, let's dive into our discussion. You're known, you have been outspoken, about this area for a while now. You know, you're speaking at various, you've been an expert voice on the PBM sort of space and how they relate to pharma. You've watched it evolve closely. Of course, there's this whole debate, on the rising price of medicines in the U.S., at the point of care, right? Mm-hmm. Pharma blames PBMs. PBMs blame the manufacturers. In any case, PBMs have been under intense scrutiny lately. From your perspective, where is this conversation, this whole thing, still missing the mark? What do you think?
So I think there is finally and only recently a general kind of understanding in the public of the fact that higher PBM fees and higher rebates demanded by the PBMs are one of the reasons drug prices is high. And that's very recent. It was typically only always Big Pharma's fault. It was always Big Pharma's increasing drug prices. Only recently, due to some hearings and some publications and some good journalism out there, has it really finally been made clear to the average consumer of U.S. pharmaceuticals that, these high rebates, these PBMs demand to get access are what's causing the higher prices. Now, where it's missing the mark is that is not the only way PBMs make money. And I think there's been a lot of focus on the pass-through. And, so PBMs are collecting all these rebates. Maybe the problem will be solved if PBMs just made sure to pass through those rebates in their entirety to employers or to patients, and then we'd solve this problem. When in the end, PBMs are these massive organizations that make money in far more ways and extract value from the system in far more ways than just rebates. And though it's good there's finally focus on PBM rebates, it's missing the mark that there's only focus on just that one instance of rebates and whether it's being passed through or not.
Makes sense. What's sort of your thinking on the PBM argument? They contend that the root cause of high costs, is the high list price set by manufacturers. PBMs claim that they work to drive down those costs for the payers. Do you see any rationale in that argument? Or
I think it's very convenient that the PBMs can make that argument. However, I think it's fundamentally flawed. The historical negotiations, whether formal or informal, or pressure between PBMs and manufacturers is that PBMs demand higher and higher rebates for manufacturers to maintain formulary or maintain access to their drugs. So if you have higher and higher rebates, the only way for a manufacturer to even maintain the same margin on a drug is to increase the list price. So you can say, and you can make the argument that it's the high list prices that are causing the rebates, but in actuality, it goes both ways. The rebates are causing the high list prices. I remember back in during the first Trump administration when he tried to, or his HHS at that point tried to mandate Part D rebates being passed through completely to the patients, that there was this full court press advertising in Washington, D.C. on account of several PBMs talking about the hundreds of millions of dollars of discounts that they've negotiated from drug manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And I kept seeing those ads and those billboards and saying, well, how do you think those drug manufacturers were able to afford to pay you hundreds of millions of dollars in discounts? They had to raise their prices. I think it's definitely goes both ways.
Is there specific data or evidence out there that would help correct some of those misconceptions? Is there data that we can that the public can see that would validate their arguments?
Yeah, Mike, that's a good question, and I would say no. Okay. I would say that for drug pricing nerds like you and I, who do this for a living, we know the blogs to read and we know the information to read and digest, so we understand the careful math between AWP and WAC and list price and all these things. Yeah. But to get understanding to a to the average consumer who is frustrated the price they're being charged at the pharmacy counter is very difficult because it requires understanding of formulary, it requires understanding of rebates, of price protection, of all these things. I think, you know, that is why PBMs, despite increased scrutiny, are still getting away with a lot of value extraction without adding a lot of actual value to the system.
It's hard to just break down that data for the layman, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You tell a person, you know, I'm sure, you know, people know what I do for a living. So they say, hey, you know, why are drugs so expensive? It's a common thing. And I try to say basically that it's pay to play. Manufacturers must pay the PBMs in order to get this. And then PBMs want more payments and they pit manufacturers in the same therapeutic class against each other, you know, and then people's eyes just glaze over. So I don't blame them.
Yeah, it's tough to convey that message. What about when you talked with your pharmaceutical clients? What are they most concerned about today when it comes to PBMs, like right now?
So a few things. So Model N serves, I'd say, the overwhelming lion's share of the top 100 pharmaceutical companies. We have a lot of good understanding, good relationships with these manufacturers. A few things is the rebranding, I would say. So, you know, because of this increased scrutiny on rebates, I mean, And now PBMs are saying, oh, we now officially pass through all of our rebates. Only they've renamed the formulary payments to now be fees, and they renamed the entity that collects those fees to be a GPO, not a PBM. So you're now paying incredible high rebates to Ascent, which is a GPO, when essentially it's the same thing for the same purpose, is to get access for your drug.
Okay.
So I see a lot of manufacturers concerned that it's more of the same, just rebrand, basically. I will also say that there is dramatically increased concern on the manufacturers of duplicate discounts, particularly in the PBM data. And the manufacturers realize that it really is up to the manufacturers to prohibit that versus assuming the PBM will be able to handle that in their data prior to submitting it for rebates. Also, the more programs you participate in, the more these problems are going to be exacerbated. So, for example, if you participate in Medicaid and Medicare and TRICARE and 3B, and you have commercial discounts and price protection and other things, and on top of that, your drug is subject to maximum fair price, those can all stack together and require deduplication across the entire set. And there are manufacturers like that, especially as MFP increases the number of manufacturers it hits every year.
Wow. Run through that deduplication problem again.
It's probably the biggest problem in manufacturers that we're seeing right now, which is them understanding and making sure and leveraging data and analysis and data collection and lawsuits to deterministically try to see whether a unit was already sold at a discount so they don't pay additional rebates already on that same unit that was sold at a discount. That's you could go negative on a unit very quickly if you don't have good data cross-referencing.
You mentioned formularies before. Obviously, they're central to how access is negotiated. How confident are manufacturers that those agreements are being carried out as intended?
I'm shockingly not confident. You know, it's interesting. If you read these PBM agreements, there are many, many pages. And there's lots of detail in the asterisks and the footnotes.
Really?
It's really incredible how things get squeezed in there. But at the end of the day, there is a well-laid-out understanding of the manufacturer is paying certain rebates with the intention of receiving certain formulary positions. And whether it's access at all, whether it's one of several drugs accessible for that therapeutic class, or whether it's they're paying a super high rebate and they're the only drug that this plan will cover for that plan. There's a reasonable expectation that the PBM will adhere to that. But what we're seeing is it's iffy at best. And manufacturers who, after the fact, do an audit of even just their biggest PBM contracts can find millions of dollars in overpayment. So we're trying to move that more up front so you don't pay and chase. You potentially don't pay to begin with.
So in turn, then, what are there some mechanisms? Are there existing mechanisms today or emerging ones to verify formulary compliance?
Yes. So the traditional has been after the fact. It's basically you're looking at your rebate structure, your formulary structure. You look at what you paid. You then get some from a company like Fingertip or one of these other companies to see what the formulary actually was at that time, and you do a delta. What we're trying to do at Model N, and we've had some great success with recently, is essentially do that analysis before the rebate is even paid. So when you're actually calculating the initial rebate, if there is a difference between the formulary as it's actually presented and the formulary that you're expecting or that you're entitled to based on the payer contract that you signed, call that out before you even make the payment. Now, just because Model N or whatever system you use or manual process you have. Is a discrepancy between the formulary that's being honored by the PBM and the formulary you expect in your contract. Doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have to pay that rebate. But at the very least, it gives you a phone call to make.
Okay.
You call the PBM, you call the plan saying, hey, you know, such and such plan of New York, you know, is off. I see my drug coexisting with three other drugs on that tier. I have a contract. I'm supposed to be the only drug on that tier. So even if you don't not pay the rebate, it gives you that warnings that you could take corrective action to limit inappropriate rebate exposure in the future.
Does the payer then, kind of in theory, do they sort of appreciate that transparency, you would think? Or?
No. That's a little bit too resolute of a no. Yeah. Not really. Because if you think about it, and this exists across pharma,
okay,
where it is not in the payer's benefit to really be clean with their data. The reason why payers don't invest tremendously in making sure that they don't send 3B units in their script files with the rest of the units that they're sending is because if the manufacturer can't accurately deduplicate, well, then the payer gets a higher rebate. Woohoo. And it's the same type of thing with formulary. If the payer doesn't meticulously honor all the formulary requirements that were agreed to and the manufacturer doesn't audit or doesn't have the ability to preempt it, well, then the payer makes more money. So the onus is on the manufacturer to make sure every penny of revenue is only out the door if it's actually contracted.
So proactively, they can cross-check all that ahead of time.
Exactly. And Mike, this goes across all pharmaceutical rebates. We can't be talking about distributor chargebacks and, you know, how it's the onus is on the manufacturer to make sure they only pay the chargebacks that they're owed. We go to Medicaid. You know, there's a huge amount of dirty data and inflated rebate requests coming at the manufacturer, and the manufacturer themselves has to have the tools to make sure they're only paying what they're contracted to pay.
Wow. Which sort of kind of leads into the next question I had for you. I guess you've kind of already touched on it, but where do you see the biggest disconnect today between what pharma companies, drug makers believe they've contracted for and what actually, you know, occurs in the market?
You know, with these behemoth vertically integrated healthcare companies, that's becoming harder and harder to also track the discounts that you're giving on your drug. Because if you have a healthcare company that is a wholesaler and is also a specialty pharmacy and is also a mail order pharmacy and is also a PBM, it's possible that you could have individual contracts with all these different entities, and you could have one unit that routes through all of those contracts, gets all those discounts, and then that's a very deeply discounted unit you never intended on doing. So managing those things, especially with all this consolidation out there, and more so, and you've written about this in your magazine, often you don't know that the provider you're going to or the pharmacy you're going to is actually owned by Optum. It's becoming more and more complicated.
You mean the average person wouldn't know that.
Exactly, right? Exactly. Yeah. It's becoming more and more complicated.
Yeah. I mean, does it feed into this overall lack of data correlation? I mean, you see out there, you read out there, the data has shown that there's not always a direct link, right, between high rebates paid to PBMs and then translated to lower prices for patients. And, you know, some drugs have high prices without even offering rebates at all. So is it just feed into this whole general lack of data correlation?
For what you're asking there specifically, it really comes down to what makes more money for the PBM.
Okay.
And in certain cases, PBMs, even if there is a significantly lower cost drug out there, and we're seeing this in the case of biosimilars, where there's a biosimilar on the market now and it's considerably lower cost than the historically branded version of a drug, that a lot of plans still go with the branded version just because they get that high rebate and they like that high rebate. And if a patient still has a high deductible plan or has run out of patient assistance, they could be subject to that high price because that's what their plan steers them to. So that is a case. We also see the cases where we call it the rebate wall. That's what we've also seen it. And, you know, but to answer the first part of your question, that's what PBMs are trying to say in this most recent year of PBM reform. That's what they're trying to say they're resolving. They're trying to say that those rebates that we get, we pass them through now. To the actual patient, I haven't seen a lot of evidence of that. Like a patient in his or her deductible phase paying full price for a drug that their plan steers them towards and then getting money back from PBM or from their employer via the PBM. I just don't see that. And if any of our listeners are seeing instances of that, please, I'd love to read about it.
Yeah, please email us or call in.
Please.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that. So PBMs are, they contend that they're passing all the rebates through the system. How does that fit with the, you know, arguments from others that they're benefiting from spread pricing?
Yeah. So they redefine what rebate means.
Okay.
Again, I'm speaking very generally here because no two PBMs are alike. Some are further on in their reform. Some are being pressured. There's been some FTC decisions. You know, so I'm speaking very generally here. But broadly speaking, a lot of the past couple years' announcements of passing through rebates, it's a very subset that they now define as rebates of the data coming – of the dollars coming from the manufacturer. And the rest is categorized as fees and other things, and those are not passed through or aren't passed through to the same extent. And so you could, that's the easiest way of looking at it. There's other aspects, other things they collect that they've just redefined. They don't call those rebates. But the rebates, they pass through. But rebates are only a small amount of the dollars they're collecting from the manufacturers.
Oh, okay.
They're smaller than they used to be, I should say.
The next question, it kind of feeds into this whole, visibility, this whole visibility issue. How much visibility do manufacturers really have into whether rebate claims are accurate?
It behooves any manufacturer to assume it is not and to do it on your own. And that goes for both payer PBM rebates, but also for Medicaid. You do get the claim details with your invoice from Ascent. You get the claim details with your invoice from the state of Wisconsin. It behooves any manufacturer to actually calculate the rebate that you owe based on applying your own set of rules from the contract that you signed to that data. More often than not, if not every time, you're going to likely see that you owe less than the invoice coming from the PBM. It's because you're able to scrub data out, whether it's simple things like they're duplicates, or we spoke about earlier, the formulary positions were incorrect, or really complicated coordination of benefits questions about this unit is technically should be paid under this contract first and removed from the set of data for this contract. I think our validator product has 150 different validations on it. And that's the reason that it exists, is there's a pre-assumption that the invoice you get is not going to be accurate and you need to scrub and apply the contract terms of the data on your own.
Okay. And that's a usual thing that these tools do.
That was a realization, over the 20 years I've been at Model N, 21 years almost, God, I've seen that realization come. Like, there used to be still manufacturers who would just pay as invoiced, and they would assume that the PBM had good things. But over time, manufacturers, particularly large ones, particularly large branded ones, started realizing that, wait, if we don't do our own calculations and our own scrubbing, we're having tremendous revenue leakage.
And I guess with technology advances, it has the reliability of these tools has gotten better and better, right?
Yeah, but also as technology advances, complexity in the pharma space also has advanced. And the number of programs, for example, MFP didn't exist a few years ago. Most Favored Nation didn't exist a few years ago. So yes, the technology advances with time, but the amount of technical and business requirement complexity the technology has to support also advances with time. So it's neck and neck.
How about a situation here? How about when more than one payer is involved in a claim? How well does a system work today from the manufacturer's point of view?
So that is a large problem, and that goes down to coordination of benefits. And we touched on this a little bit earlier, because you have potentially the same unit appearing on multiple files requesting rebates. Uh-huh. So that unit could come in, the identical unit, come in and be seeking a maximum fair price refund. That unit could also come in then on a commercial file because it was mistaken. It could also come in on a Most Favored Nation, or that unit could also come in even in a Medicaid file. And if you don't have the ability and the identifiers, to your point, to really, I say, that is that same unit, I'm going to determine based on my rules which rebate that actually deserves, pay that one and not the others, then you can go negative real fast on a unit by paying four different rebates when it only earned one. And that's a big problem. And manufacturers are handling that today, but it's requiring a lot of new tools, new analyses, and new best practices.
Okay. Where do you think coordination breaks down most in multi-payer claims? Is it the data sharing? Is it the timing, incentives?
So I would say it's 340B. And I would say it's also, yes, it's the timing and it's data sharing. The 340B rebate model is not yet a thing. It was going to be a thing, and then it got pulled a few days before the new year. So right now, when manufacturers, particularly those subject to MFP, they don't know often deterministically when they pay an MFP refund whether or not that unit was dispensed to a 340B patient.
Okay.
So that's a big problem right now. You've seen certain things in the press about hospitals and other covered entities very upset that they have MFP refunds being denied when they insist this was not a 340B dispensing event. So that's something that's happening right now. With time and technology and a better understanding, again, MFP has only been a thing for 3.5 months now. That will get better, but that's probably the biggest problem right now is deterministic understanding of a unit and whether or not that was originally dispensed from 340B in inventory. That's a very hot topic.
Wow. Maybe that kind of feeds into this question for you. Why has coordination of benefits remained such a persistent challenge for the industry?
That you put it best. Availability of data and timing, and timing of data that is deterministic.
Okay.
And when I mean deterministic, it means data that you get from the source so you could prove a unit was dispensed from 340B inventory or was subject to MFP, something like that, versus data science, which a lot of solutions have used historically, which is, okay, well, I don't know whether this unit, but hey, I can look at the provider on the line and I can see the provider works at a 340B facility on Tuesday.
Yep.
This script was written on a Tuesday. I'm embellishing there, but you know, there's always been probabilistic analysis that's hard to defend and very often might not be the case. So it's the deterministic thing that's gotten very difficult.
What do you think about the rise of alternative or independent PBMs that you're seeing kind of emerge, looking to kind of take advantage of the, you have the three big PBMs are, they're under a lot of scrutiny for arguments of not being transparent with how they pass through rebates and all the stuff we've been talking about. So these are all, these independent PBMs are trying to kind of, position themselves around transparency. What do you think of this sort of trend and how different do you think these models are?
So I have yet to see, it doesn't mean it's not there, PBM that one of these newer, smaller ones that really turned the whole model on its head. At the end of the day, employers want to save money for their employees. And that means collecting rebate dollars that they like. And so at the end of the day, the traditional PBM rebate model allows for that. Now, what I have seen in some of these smaller PBMs, they, instead of pushing for higher rebates to get access and then doing the traditional pass-through, they're leveraging more gimmicks. It's not a gimmick, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
For like accumulators and maximizers. And they save, they claim that the way that they save employers money is versus not, is basically maximizing the patient assistance program from the pharmaceutical manufacturer versus collecting a rebate. So definitely know some of the smaller, more innovative PBMs, they really rely heavily on those. And I guess that's innovative, that's different. But at the end of the day, that's just milking a program and getting money from it for the purposes of saving the employer and the PBM itself money.
So you haven't really seen any kind of demonstrated, measurable outcomes yet from these sort of
Really. I mean, we have seen some PBMs just basically agree to purchase the or cover the low-priced drugs, cost-plus type
yes, cost-plus.
That type things where you've seen a few PBMs say, okay, we're just going to pay without demanding a rebate. We're just going to pay for the cheaper version of this product because it just makes sense. But those make the news when that happens. And that hasn't become a new way of doing things. More so, there's specific drugs and specific places for specific PBMs where they do that versus preferring, a high price, high rebate.
Yeah. You mentioned cost plus drugs, like alternative kind of pharmacy models like those. They basically have been focused on generic drugs, but you hear about them taking on some of these specialty drugs as well. Do you see any viability though those sort of models? Their whole PR thing is, we're bypassing the PBM, or we're a better alternative than the traditional PBM.
So yes, but only for specific therapeutic classes. So this goes over to, we're kind of veering into almost direct-to-patient pricing.
Which is close,
what we're saying. Yeah. So a manufacturer, whether through their own website or TrumpRx or through GoodRx or via Cost Plus, branded manufacturers are increasingly offering lower priced versions of their drugs that skip insurance altogether. Those are still expensive. I want to be clear. It's still expensive. Like you're not getting it. For most Americans, if the WAC for a product is $1,300 and you get it for $400, yes, that's a big discount. But $400 a month is still very expensive for most Americans. Now, but there are certain things, weight loss, fertility, things like that, that people will be willing to spend that. And for those therapeutic classes, I think this is a very big deal. I think direct-to-patient pricing and cost plus and branded drugs, I think you're seeing tremendous expansion. I read some statistic about the number of new Zepbound, Lilly's weight loss drug prescriptions going through this channel with cash-paying patients. It's staggeringly high. I forget what it is, though. So I think, you know, for those types of things, fertility, weight loss, you'll see this. But I don't think somebody's going to start paying for their cancer drug or their cholesterol drug or their diabetes drug direct to patient. They're going to want that covered by their plan.
Okay. We're still going to be in the traditional system.
Yeah. At the end of the day, all the direct to patient things that we're talking about, TrumpRx, everything, yes, that does expand access a little bit to the patients I was just talking about, patients who can afford it, who need these therapies, and that's good. Any access expansion is good. The real access expansion comes when you expand coverage, not expand coverage. We actually get in plans and PBMs to cover more drugs.
More on formularies.
Exactly. More on formulary with lower copays. That's real access expansion. Everything else is just kind of increasing bits here and there for certain types of drugs.
Window dressings, yeah. From what you're seeing, do these newer PBMs, are they looking at addressing the kinds of issues that manufacturers are concerned about, do you think?
I have not seen that.
You haven't seen that?
But what I've seen, especially these newer PBMs, they're trying to leverage like alternative funding models. They're trying to use these types of ways of getting access to things, which we already know about, and it's not innovative, and you could argue that it's not even fair. You should just cover the drug.
Okay. I also wanted to get your thoughts on the recent policy sort of reforms in the works, you know, trying to address the PBM area. There was a Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2026. Which includes measures to increase PBM transparency. I don't think it takes effect, though, until 2028. What's your take on it? Do you think you see it as a kind of turning point for PBMs?
I'm going to be optimistic here, Mike.
Okay.
I think it can be.
Okay.
And I think for certain subsets of plans, for certain PBMs, you will see, you know, what Adam Fine refers to as the gross-to-net bubble. You will see the gross-to-net bubble start to deflate. You will see the you know, high-priced, high-rebate drugs start to slow down. But it's going to be slow. It's okay. Not going to be for all covered lives at a PBM. It's going to be for a subset of plans that have certain funding first. And it's going to be for a certain subset of drugs. It's interesting if you see the debate on this, like on LinkedIn. There's also a lot of people like to point out loopholes in these laws and FTC regulations that will allow the PBM to still, in certain ways, go back to the old way of doing things.
Oh, really?
Okay. But it's progress. This is good. I think we're going in that direction, but it'll be slow.
Does it maybe provide a glimpse of future reforms in this area?
It's hard to say. I will say the current administration, although they're pushing for PBM transparency, which is good, they seem to be more focused on cash prices, direct to patient, most favored nation. They seem to be more focused on independent agreements with manufacturers versus wholesale PBM reform.
But do you see, maybe in this case, in the case of this law, will manufacturers kind of have to adapt in a way, you know, or kind of prepare for it to take effect in how they negotiate with the bigger sort of PBMs?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've never been privy. I would love to. To be in the room when a large branded manufacturer is negotiating with a large PBM, because I'm sure the data they must bring to the table is incredible. So I wouldn't be able to tell you details. I'm not familiar, but you could be certain that all the payer strategy teams at all the manufacturers are carefully monitoring the FTC regs and the new types of contracts that are out there.
Have you noticed any other kind of similar reform efforts? I know Congress was kind of visiting PBMs in recent years, but do you see that sort of coming back? Or
I think that will continue. It's very hard to break the decades-old inertia that all the problems with access to drugs are the drug manufacturer's fault. It's hard to break that. And there's still certain politicians on both sides of the aisle that prefer that easy cut and dry, you know, tweet length, you know, motto versus really understanding the difficulties and dynamics of the drug system, inclusive of PBM rebates.
Uh-huh.
So while I think definitively, and it's as evidenced by some of the things you brought up, that pressure on PBMs to change and to reform will increase, I don't think it will match the pressure on drug pricing at manufacturers that they're already been facing. You know, inflation rebates are being put on them. Again, 340B, I could go on and on.
Gotcha. Excellent. Well, I appreciate all these insights. Yeah, maybe in closing, if you look ahead a few years, where do you expect the biggest pressure point to be for manufacturers when it comes to PBMs?
So it's a good question. I will say that the biggest pressure point is going to be the fact that there are the ability for manufacturers to raise their price on drugs over time is being limited now. So that implies, for that reason, manufacturers are doing very high launch prices. And additionally, the real innovative drugs that are coming out nowadays, like for cancer and genetic therapies, are already by their nature by the value that they give, supposed to be very high priced.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that's going to be the next very big push. All these specialty drugs coming out, high launch prices, a lot of barriers to coverage thrown at them by the PBMs. Uh-huh. I think that's going to be for a lot of manufacturers for oncology, genetic therapies. That's going to be something interesting to watch.
And when you say high launch prices, you mean the list price?
The list price. Okay. You got it.
In that case, what capabilities or strategies should manufacturers prioritize now to prepare for that specific pressure you're talking about?
Well, it's interesting. So, you know, we've been fortunate to work with a few manufacturers who have done recent launches for really innovative, incredible drugs. And they start working with the payers 2 years prior to launch. They do tremendous amounts of analysis, data collection, comparative clinical and real world ideal outcomes, you know, competitors in that therapeutic class. And we've seen some real good examples of some manufacturers, when the drug does go to market, already have very strong payer coverage. So I think there is it's possible for the manufacturers to put their boots on and get out there to get coverage, even if it is going to be a high launch price. Because at the end of the day, if there's long-term value to the drug being covered, PBMs want to cover it.
Okay. So it's not necessarily deterring, because I mean, you hear different things that they're being more discerning now, companies with a product launch. But you're saying that they are more confident now in some of these launches.
It just requires more work. More interesting contracting arrangements. Okay. You could be sure price protection is all over those contracts. You could be sure these manufacturers for these new drugs had to make certain guarantees to PBMs, whether it's outcomes-based or adherence or contract or price protected, to get them on there. But they're on there. They are covered. Uh-huh. So that requires more work, more complexity, and more ability to administer.
Does that put the onus on getting a new level of expertise when it comes to some of these contracts?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So particularly with these genetic treatments.
Oh, okay.
You know, with these drugs that are seven figures, but they're incredible. You know, I think I've said before, maybe even in a conversation with your magazine, you know, we're in the golden age of medicine. You know, we're actually seeing curative approaches out there and curative therapies for things like sickle cell and for hemophilia. But these are multi-million-dollar treatments. Absolutely. Manufacturers who have launched those have had to exercise new muscles of how do they get payers to pay for that? How do they prove the long-term value that it makes more sense to cure somebody's sickle cell for several million dollars than it does to treat that person for sickle cell for the rest of their life. So absolutely, there's a lot of new analyses going on out there.
Yeah, and you sort of need those because you always, right, you hear one thing, you hear, this is the price, right? This is the price the patient has to pay. And then you hear from the other side, well, this is what the healthcare system would save if you could keep on my treatment, right?
Yes, but because you work in this industry, you said that second piece. You know, it's interesting. There's a new drug launched recently from a manufacturer that is a twice a year pre-exposure prophylactic drug for HIV. Uh-huh. Basically, you get two shots a year. It's almost like a vaccine. They're not calling it that, but you get two shots a year, and you don't get HIV even if you're exposed. And that's this manufacturer's pricing at a very high price. And so the coverage of that is, oh, why is it so, you know, this amazing, you know, vaccine for HIV? But if you think of the value that it gets, that's an incredibly great deal versus a lifelong treatment of HIV drugs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you know, you have to look at it from that perspective as well. And that's the very valid point that pharmaceutical manufacturers make. But typically in the broader media, it's just that drug is priced high, evil big pharma.
What about public sentiment, though? Do you see them coming around a little bit to you know, when they hear a curative therapy, you know, like you said, you have one or two doses, and in some cases, you're essentially cured. Does the public sort of reconcile that?
So I think so, and I think it's because of that specific reason. People thought they were dying of hepatitis C 15 years ago are now cured, but also all the patient assistance programs out there. You know, if you cannot afford your medication, AstraZeneca may be able to help. Like anybody who watches TV could recite that. And so most people, including myself, who are on branded medications are leveraging copay cards, copay assistance from the manufacturer. And I think that goes a long way to show, look, I'll put it this way.
Okay.
I'll put it this way. Like, no manufacturer can make any money if they can't get the pill in your mouth or the needle in your arm. The manufacturer wants you desperately to have access to their drug via cash or your insurance or a public program. They're the ones who want it in you. So to blame them as being the hindrance to you getting the drug versus your insurance company or PBM, which actually makes money when you don't take it, is just a backwards thinking out there. And no drug manufacturer can make a penny or employ people or invent new drugs if they can't get their existing drugs to patients.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds simple, right? The whole argument, but so many layers. It's been great. I really, really appreciate all the insights and drilling down into this whole area of PBMs and trying to kind of understand the whole evolution and then you weave in all the policy stuff too. So thanks. I appreciate you joining us. It's been great having you.
I appreciate it. It's good to be here. It's good to be here in person too.
Yeah. I know we have a long-time relationship with you virtually. It's good to finally get you in the same room. So thanks again.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone out there for joining us. I'm Mike Christel. We hope you enjoyed this episode in Farm Exec series exploring how leaders are responding to pricing and policy pressures in today's rapidly changing industry.